everybody. It's Kathleen McFerrin, and we are headed into our fourth integrating NVC teleclass at the NVC Academy. I know last week that we were focusing our attention on the element of thought and how that fits into NVC. And we spend a lot of our time looking at how to uncover core beliefs that act as filters for our worldview, particularly the ones that we might call jackal beliefs that prevent us from experiencing the world in the way that might be congruent with our values or the way that we might enjoy. There's another aspect of thought that, and I wanted to give that a little bit more airtime and space here, just to go back into the thought, and it's the ideas that our thoughts and thinking can be of great service to life, particularly when there's a lot of space given to them, with the awareness that in reflection lies a very powerful tool. And it could simply be that today is rainy and kind of cold, and I love that time of reflection. Maybe that's why I wanted to bring it up. It's something that I try to protect on a daily basis, that quiet time for myself. And I know that I would not have been able to stay centered without it up to this point, and can't imagine walking this life path, the NVC, without time to reflect. Joseph Jaworski, in his book Synchronicity, he's one of the authors in the book Presence that I've been quoting. This is more his personal journey in the book Synchronicity. And he talks about his need for reflection, so I'm going to quote that. The sense of true freedom and clarity of purpose that I had experienced in the early days after returning from London began to erode. He's talking about taking on a new job. I was being forced to operate at a pace that I found uncomfortable. I do best when I have plenty of time to reflect on things and process what's going on. That's the way I stayed anchored in the midst of the necessary chaos. And that was fine in the early days of this organization when the pace was less frenetic. But now I wasn't able to control the pace, and the more I operated at others' pace, the less clear and coherent I could be about my internal direction. The key to overcoming the trap of overactivity is in doing the inner reflective work, individually and collectively necessary to regain our balance. In the heat of the creative process, we end up having so much to do that we lose the necessary orientation to stay in the flow. Unless we have the individual and collective discipline to continually stay anchored, we will eventually lose the flow. I would love to hear, I'm guessing that both of you have some practices or ways that you find that quiet time, reflective time, when you can really find some kind of congruency between being connected to your needs and values and using your mind and thinking process to really help figure out how to manifest those in the world. Is that true, or am I making some great assumption here?
This is Mary Kay. It's an interesting question, Kathleen, because I work at home, and, you know, some of my work is bookkeeping kinds of things. I exercise every day, either at a Y or do yoga or something, and then I spend time house cleaning or cooking or puttering sorts of things. And it seems to me that I spend a lot of that time either consciously centering myself, like with some kind of mindfulness meditation, or thinking. And I loved how you were talking about thinking and how valuable it is, what a powerful tool it is. But when you ask for a specific practice, nothing really popped into my mind. So I'll have to think about that.
Yeah, it sounds pretty specific to me that, you know, you're just consciously during the exercise and just working around the house time, that I find my mind is always rolling and processing, and there's a place of honoring. I think the energy that I bring to that is part of what that creative process of just being and wanting to be connected is about.
This is Angana, and I spend a great deal of time reflecting and contemplating and, you know, just reflecting in general. What I'm really appreciating about NVC structure, having a structure. I never got into journaling as much as I would have liked in terms of writing down my thoughts and things like that. I always thought it would be a tremendously valuable thing to do, but never got into it myself. But I do it in my head a lot. And so all these different practices that I've been learning in different classes and from different trainers and these ones that you presented to us in the course of this telecourse give my reflections some structure. And I really, really appreciate that because it's something I do anyway, and it just makes it even more powerful. And I also appreciate the idea of honoring that thought process. I appreciate that tremendously because I do spend a good bit of time doing that, and I do think it's a powerful contribution to how I am in the world. So, yeah, it's a big part of my life.
And so I'm going to make this assumption again that when you said the NVC gave it structure, that there was some kind of shift for you once you were really looking at the world through the language of needs,
mm-hmm.
and that the thoughts were in service or at least congruent with those, that it made a difference in how your thoughts served you?
Absolutely.
That's certainly been my experience. I really appreciate those subtleties and get uncomfortable sometimes when I hear that, you know, the thoughts are the jackal part. And if we could just get rid of our thoughts, it's all giraffe. I want to honor the, which is why I think this whole course is that there's so much about our beings as humans that when we can line it up in service to life, that we can use all of these great facets we have.
You know, since you brought up the idea of, you know, labeling different processes as jackal processes and giraffe processes, just the whole idea that in this course, we're going much beyond any labels at all. And so I've never really enjoyed jackal and giraffe distinction. And these conversations are going so much beyond those labels. Mm-hmm. And getting much more to the heart of what it means to be in service of your value, to understand your values and to act, think, speak, and act in service to those values. And I like that so much. It feels so much more authentic and more in service of my values mm-hmm. and just more consistent. Yeah, I think we've developed a lot of labels in NVC too. Little shortcuts, little labels that possibly don't serve our growth.
Yeah, that's funny. We've developed labels to get away from labels, to get away from labels.
Yeah.
Also, I wanted to check in about the work that we did last week about core beliefs and thoughts. If you had anything that came up this past week in understanding some of your own core beliefs that you wanted to share or question, bring to the table in some way right now.
This is Mary Kay. I had a delightful week thinking about the giraffe, and I got started on that whole subject again enough so that I actually went to the CNBC website. I was curious as to what the exact wording was, guidelines for people who were interested in being certified. So I looked it up, and they're not up there anymore because they're working on them. But what was up there was a new statement about why we don't use the giraffe. And the new statement says something along the lines of, we've decided not to use this in our advertising because the giraffe does not speak to everyone in the same way. Mm-hmm. So because we want our program to be sort of universally acceptable, this is not the best symbol. And I had to laugh because I thought it doesn't translate well, basically, is what it said. It does not translate well in all cultures. So I have no problem whatsoever with this reason for not using it because my own initial impression was negative. It did not appeal to me. It sounded kind of childish, you know. It was such a different feeling when I read the new statement that I suddenly had no problem at all with not using the giraffe.
Is that because the statement was different or because you were really connected to what you wanted around the issue?
It was largely because this is a different statement.
Mm-hmm.
And my struggle before had been with the value of what you can and cannot appropriately own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you can't own the earth and you can't own all the giraffes. And therefore, it's just not appropriate to try to copyright that or to say, well,
yeah.
you know, we're going to use this and nobody else can use it. And it was partly personal. I mean, it started out because I was personally miffed, and I understood that. But the trouble was that when I got underneath it, I never had a release because I saw some need. What I came to this time was of value. that I cherished and that I was not willing to cooperate in just tossing it out the window. It was like, well, if someone comes to me and says, you know, I want to copyright all the jackals and you guys can't use jackals anymore, my answer would be, well, you know, I'd be interested in the needs of that person. But my response would be this, you know, just letting you have the jackals and saying I'm never going to use them again, that doesn't satisfy my needs. I value, you know, you can have Jerry Jackal or whoever, but you can't have all of them. Yeah, it just helped me clarify the thinking part and the values part. Mm-hmm. It made me realize again, you know, this is not about being nice. It's about being real, the honesty. Mm-hmm. But also, it completely shifted this. Oh, there are legitimate reasons that I would consider entirely legitimate and in fact are congruent with my own values for not using this sort of advertising.
Yeah, so with the shift in their statement, you were able to hear it differently.
With the shift in the statement, there was no, it would never have come up. If that had been the first thing I had seen, I would not have had the opportunity to make that other discovery about my own values. So actually, you know, I like jackals. I think they're very useful.
Mm.
I think they have very, very valuable information.
It's something about embracing whatever is and being able to look at it in a way that is compassionate and honoring whatever they have to bring.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you call it jackal, giraffe, it just, you know, here's that thought that's up. Well, thank you both. I didn't want to quite leave the thought so abruptly by starting in on something new. Do you have anything else to say about the thoughts before we head into this topic of communication?
This is Sangana, and I looked over your exercise, and the first thing I thought is that this is really nice. I've tried different things with starting with your feelings and working to what your needs might be under that. But this one, just letting the thoughts run, then trying to get into a value at the end. It's I suspect that the situation that I used, there's more there. And I'm thinking I'd like to play with this again, you know, in more depth and see where it goes. But I did feel a shift. And I also found it challenging to not think in terms of needs and values.
Yes.
It's like, well, the needs and values make so much sense now that I could go to them quite easily. And the story was pretty short, actually. I didn't have this much of a story. But I did feel a shift. The question at the end about, is this serving you? And how is it serving you? And would you like it to serve in a different way? And those are really, really good questions to work from. And I love the idea of having all these questions to guide my reflections on things. It's not just random stream of, I mean, it is, it starts out being random stream of consciousness, but you've got questions that help clarify things and actually come to some conclusion. And I really, really liked that. So to connect it up to today's topic, I teach a communication skills class for a school for Oriental medicine practitioners. This course is such a help. It's helping me define what my goals are and what skills I would really like these folks to have. And it occurred to me that on the first day of this class, you had said something about how much you appreciated the care that Marshall took in coming up with the four components. And choosing those components, the observations, feelings, needs, requests, his model for NBC. And I went back thinking about this whole idea about needs and universal needs and how we have this needs list and everybody works from the needs list to try and start developing their thing. And I'm going, you know, I want to go the other way around. I want to actually have each student for themselves start where Marshall started, when there wasn't a vocabulary, and say, off this needs list, what I'd like you to do is go through and look at these qualities and decide which are most important to you,
mm-hmm.
and then develop your own needs list. Develop your own list of values that meet the criteria of being universal and being vital
mm-hmm.
to any living being in your mind. So that's the assignment for this week. I'll find out on Saturday how they did with that.
Yeah, and there's a sense of really participating in that needs consciousness, so it's really one that they resonate with.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And then they can connect better from a very personal space rather than here's a needs list. Now guess.
Well, yeah. I really like that, and something is flashing through my brain, and it could have been like one of your check-ins at the very beginning of the class about wanting to use this language in a way that felt natural. Didn't you say that? And my hunch is that what you're doing right now is the key to that, because I know that if I'm trying to speak with a need language, I want to adapt it to whoever I'm speaking to, so that I'm really using their language and what they would call their values. And so it sounds like your exercise is doing exactly that.
Oh, good.
I have sense for me. I've done the, you know, I use words that really resonate for me, and I struggle to translate them into somebody else's language.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing that what you're doing is giving your students a starting point for them so that they really can grasp it on a cellular level, what a need is, what's important to them, and then they can feel that energy.
Yeah.
And then moving up from there to finding a lot of different words that may not resonate for them but may resonate for somebody else.
Exactly. So that's when this exercise with the thoughts from last week is what I'm going to offer them, you know, after we've done all this and shared our personal needs lists, and then ask them to pick a situation. It fits so beautifully in connecting it back to those values that they come to identify, and then go to the feeling, because feelings are probably the most challenging, I think, because they're so all-consuming.
Up in our culture. Mixed up, too.
Yeah.
I appreciate that reflection. Communication. This is the topic that I just kind of go, what? Haven't we been talking about that the whole time? This, for me, is really a chance to explore the energy behind the message and the ways that our messages are sent without the language. The communication we're talking about right now is all the communicating that happens when the words are missing. I do know that I was pondering possible directions to go with this element today. It just seems so vast. So what I'll bring to the dialogue today is an exploration of the internal process that manifests externally. So it's very linked to consciousness, thoughts, and language. One component that I'd like to talk about in greater detail is that role that choice plays in our communication. So it seems like the internal choices that we make before we use language is a key part of our communication, and then that will manifest on the outside. So we make choices to use empathy or honesty, choices to share our thinking or to analyze, choices on how we hear what the other person's saying. And all of these choices has a greater effect on our message than the actual words that we use. It shapes the energy of the message, and so intention is a critical piece of this. I really hope that you will share with me the things you find important and interesting about the aspects of communication that go beyond language. So, for instance, you might have an interest in nonverbal body language that we use, or you might be familiar with scientific research about physiology and the chemical reactions that affect our communication. So I'm hoping that it might work in terms of logistics if I share with you an NVC perspective of choice, and then we just open up the discussion and let it run from there. So starting with choice, the key to understanding nonviolent communication is the awareness that we all have choice. So we have this enormous power at every moment to serve life through our skills, our words, our touch, our service, our thoughts. And the corollary to that is the awareness of how joyful it is to use that power. So when we're in touch with how good it feels to serve, it's really a wonder that we do anything but that. In order for us not to do that, we really have to be disconnected from choice. So when we're connected to choice, we find ourselves going back to that place of being connected to our power and the joy that we have in our power. And so before we open our mouths, of course, we have all these choices to make. Do I start with self-empathy, or do I go with empathy for the other person? And we actually choose the direction of our conversation. And those choices are happening every moment. When we're aware of our choice, we get in touch with our own sense of power to create and contribute, and the sense of self-responsibility that goes along with that, that I get to co-create. There's a quote from Peter Block's book, Stewardship, that I like around this. It's called, "Empowerment embodies the belief that the answer to the latest crisis lies within each of us, and therefore we all buckle up for adventure. This requires a belief that my safety and my freedom are in my own hands. No easy task, and therefore the adventure." I like that because I take on the responsibility of choosing and being responsible without knowing what the outcome's going to be. And then behind choice lies my intention. It's another area that deeply affects the energy of my communication. This, of course, cycles us back to the idea that consciousness permeates all the elements of NBC. Find that when I reach challenging moments in conversations, when I'm becoming more defensive of whatever strategy I'm advocating, then I check in with my intention or my consciousness. See if I'm really holding to the energy of creating the quality of connection that leads to all needs being equally valued and met through natural giving. Usually that I find I've shifted my agenda away from connection to getting my own way. And when I reset my focus, this is all internal, when I reset my internal focus to trusting the connections, the pathway to meeting needs, then I find that my tone of voice changes, my face and my eyes soften, and my body relaxes. And somehow, the conversation shifts, because I'm sure the other person senses that. So enough from me. First, I'd like to hear reactions to what I put out there around choice and intention and how that affects the energy of the communication. And after that, I'd love to hear what other things you consider important in exploring communication that doesn't involve language. And I'm going to take good notes while you're doing that so I can do some more research in all these great areas that I'm sure are going to come up.
Well, I was just thinking that when you were talking about choice and intention, I was thinking how wonderful it would be if I was always truly aware of those possibilities every time I opened my mouth. Instead of just sort of unconsciously speaking. And I thought attention is another thing that I would add to that list. First of all, I have to be paying attention, and then I can have intention and choice that's conscious. Because I think an awful lot of my talking is an automatic pilot.
And attention is where we choose where we're attention, our attention.
Yeah,
I like that.
To be awake, you know. Really, not only just listening to what somebody just said, but also to be listening to myself, my own kind of attention, intention, and choice.
See, now it seems so huge because, okay, all this choice about do I pay attention to myself, do I pay attention to the other person, and if I am paying attention, what am I going to be paying attention to? Where's my energy? What's my...
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I recently discovered Jon Kabat-Zinn's writing on mindfulness. His latest book is called Coming to Our Senses. It's huge. It's in this 8.5 by 11 format, and it's 600 pages.
Wow.
But it's very conversational, and the chapters are, you know, self-contained, so you don't have to read them all in order. And they're all so thought-provoking. So it's a book that not only takes a while to read because it's physically so big, but there's a lot of juice in it and a lot of things to reflect on. But it's all about if we could just come to our senses, really pay attention to that present moment, that would be the key, that would be the catalyst for so much else, for our intentions and for the choices we make and for the impact we have on our world. And it's a wonderful book. The meditation CDs that go along with it are great. I incorporated that a lot too because a lot of different trainers have talked about presence in terms of describing empathy, describing that process of empathy, of giving empathy. And they come to me and say, well, you know, you have to have presence. Let's try to be more present. It was very vague, and I thought, this is a skill that we would all benefit from exploring in a little more detail.
So I want to make sure I capture this. So seeing that as part of communication is how it would shift if we were just really aware of all the information coming in through our senses that kept us really grounded in the present moment.
Yeah.
That in and of itself would really change the energy that was behind the words we used.
Yeah. And I think having that information available would help us make those choices with much more ease.
Because
I know we were saying earlier about what do I pay attention to? And this just gives us an option of being able to pay attention to it all, of just simply paying attention, and how we might go about doing that in a concrete way, how we might go about doing that so that we can make the choices in our communication, in our connections, in our interactions that'll serve us in a really natural way.
Now, Angela, let me share with you that in the Freedom Project, when we go into the prisons and do the work, we do NVC and mindfulness, because Lucy Liu, who developed the program, she doesn't know how you could possibly do NVC without mindfulness, because it brings you to that place, and we do teach the mindfulness skills of being present in the moment in your senses, simply so that we call it coming home, so that you have a place where you're connected with yourself, so that out of that place you can connect with others as well.
Yeah.
That's where I've heard Jon Kabat-Zinn's name, is through the trainings that we've done there. I really appreciate you bringing this up too. It's very powerful. He just has his own way of being present and really grounded.
You know, I think that's really fascinating, the thought that mindfulness meditation might be one technique for learning presence or attention in the moment, but that there might be others. It would be really interesting to have a list of either whole systems like mindfulness meditation or specific techniques like paying attention to how your body is feeling that help to focus our attention on the present moment.
We could spend weeks on that, but that would be a great component of this communication, is just all the different ways to come from that energy we want to come from and be really connected to whatever's going on right now.
It's just a whole other component that it's a struggle for a lot of people. I don't know how to help people experience that or relate to that, to the experience of presence in their everyday lives. So it would be kind of interesting to discover what people do already that they could build on. Sometimes giving them a whole new technique is a little scary for them. But if it's something they could relate to that they already do, and put that in the context of communication, I think that could be really valuable.
Would it be interesting for you to hear a couple different presence exercises that I've learned from other people?
Definitely.
One is a completely silent present exercise, and you're in pairs and looking at each other. And the instructions are simply, you give them a starting time, and then about 30 seconds you give them an ending time. And they're simply to be with the other person. Just look softly in each other's eyes and pay attention to what comes up for you, and just be with the other person, not trying to think and not trying to analyze, but just to notice. And then at the end of 30 seconds, you can close your eyes or look down at the floor and just really be present with yourself. So noticing how you felt during that. Was it awkward? Was it uncomfortable? Was it freeing? Whatever's going on. And then when you hear the chime again, you repeat the exercise. And you do that three times. And each time they ring the chime, it's actually a longer length of time. So the first one might be 30 seconds, and the second one might be 1 minute, and the third one might be 2 minutes. And what usually happens during that time is people are always stunned at the end to learn that there was such a significant time difference, because they start to get more comfortable by the third time around. And it seems just as short as the first time around.
Oh, I love this.
And no agenda. There's no right or wrong or no agenda. So you're just simply noticing what it's like to be in somebody's presence. It's just noticing. So that's one exercise that I've done. That's pretty fun. But a second exercise is that they're given very specific things to do while they're in pairs. And you might start out simply looking into each other's eyes. And you might, then the second time, you have a person A and a person B, and person A will have 2 or 3 minutes to talk. And just to tell about anything that's, you know, they're thinking about at the moment, or a situation that's come up for them, they can choose. And person B just listens in silence and just gives them a sense of presence, what it's like to listen without reflecting back. And then the third time, person tells the story for 2 or 3 minutes, and person B then will have a couple minutes to reflect back the feelings and needs that they heard in the story. And then you do it one more time, and it's more of a dialogue. So as somebody's telling the story, then you reflect it back when you're comfortable, and person A, when they're telling the story, might stop a few times and say, do you know what I mean? And that's the cue for person B to respond. So it's more a dialogue back and forth. And then at the debrief, and you switch pairs so that A and B both get to do both parts. And then during the debrief, you just notice which was the more comfortable mode for you. Some people find a lot of comfort in just the listening and really paying attention. Some people are much more comfortable when it's more of a dialogue. Some people are terribly uncomfortable silence, and others really like the freedom of not having to respond in a certain way. So it's an interesting way to play with different ways of being present to someone and find your own comfort zone. And also get the feedback from the person to whom you're listening, where, you know, at what point did they have a sense that they're most fully heard? Was it when you were really listening without speaking, or was it when you were reflecting back? So then you also get some understanding about what you would want back from another person in order to be fully heard. So then you could ask for it. Because you might say, you know, there's something that's really, I'm feeling really tender about right now, and I'm wondering if you would just listen without saying anything back. If that's really how you think you're most, you know, you like being heard the best. Or you might say, I'm wondering if after I say a couple things, if you'd be willing to tell me back what you think is important to me. So then you could start to ask for what you want and ask for what kind of presence and response you want from somebody else. Are those two exercises helpful?
Yes. Yes, it puts it in the context that I hope to put it in.
Hmm.
What I also like about it is you've broken it down into little steps that they can explore and reflect on each part of that, each component of that, and then add another element, just being in someone's presence and what that is like and how to develop that skill in and of itself, and then listening with presence and then reflecting back. I like the progression. It's broken down in a way that it can be useful and valuable. Okay, fabulous.
You could also play with it and ask them when they're listening to the story to be making a list of advice they could give back while they're listening. You know, and to see what, you know, see what that does to your listening ability. So you could play with it and add something to it.
You know, I had the experience recently when you mentioned the list of advice of actually there were three of us, and one woman was telling a story, and I was listening but not saying anything, and I really felt that presence. And I would have to say that the space I was in felt most like just that silent presence exercise. And a third woman who was there kept offering advice. And it was just fascinating to me, because I'm always very quick to offer advice. But it was jarring to listen to all these bits of advice getting interspersed with the story. which was a very emotional one that was being told.
Mm.
And it was a wonderful lesson for me. I thought, oh, that's what it feels like, all this advice coming out, when really what I needed in that moment was just the space to hold this story, to hear this story.
So the question for you that comes up as I'm hearing you say that is, I'm wondering if when we're communicating, we're really in that space of empathy, if we can almost experience what the other person's experiencing when advice is coming towards you. It's almost as if you were in her space because you were clear and holding her needs for her. Am I going too far off the deep end here?
Or did, no.
Did it really
no,
have a sense
actually,
that you were in her space?
I've heard the word empathy used that way. People talk about empaths. When I was young, I saw a Star Trek program, but there's one of the original Star Treks that had a woman who was an empath in it, and she literally would take wounds into her body to heal them. Mm-hmm. I remember being just absolutely fascinated with that theme, because it sometimes felt to me as if I could feel another person's emotional pain. I can still remember this. I was probably a child when I saw that movie, but I don't think we even need to go there. I never go places like that if I don't have to for some good reason. But, you know, that exercise of presence, of just silently looking into
uh-huh.
another person's eyes, I have found that so powerful and very freeing. It just allows me to do that. It's like, oh, you know, other people do this. It's okay to just sit and listen and hold that space.
And do you know what, for the woman who was telling the story, do you know what her experience was between the two of you who are listening?
What I noticed is that she was looking at me. She, you know, when the other person would speak, she would turn and listen to them, and then she would turn back to me so that her gaze fell on me. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were looking into each other's eyes and then continue with her story. So my sense was that she valued that silence, the mm-hmm. silent place.
Well, Mary Kay, two thoughts came up since you did bring it up. Is this, you know, just hearing that, it seems as though for that character in Star Trek that it was a choice to choose to bring that into her body.
Was.
That was the way that it went to heal that, which brings me back to every bit of our communication seems to be choice, and just how unaware of that I am much of the time. And then, of course, there is so much debate on what empathy versus sympathy is. In NBC, the understanding, and I guess for me, I just like to play with those boundaries. I don't think I can ever feel somebody else's pain, but I certainly, when I sit in stories and listen to what's going on for people, I feel so strongly a pain that of my own that I'm guessing is similar to what theirs would be.
Oh, I love that. And I think it always is my own pain that I'm feeling. But I do think, and you know, I don't have much trouble with the difference between sympathy and empathy, because sympathy really is kind of a feeling sorry for
mm-hmm.
another person. There's actually a barrier created by that. I'm so sad this is happening to you. It's happening to you. It's not happening to me. And empathy, I think when I feel empathetic, I don't feel another person's pain. And I have the choice whether or not to open myself to hearing a story in this way so that I will actually resonate with the emotions that go with that story.
Uh-huh.
But it means I'm willing to go to that field that Rumi talks about, to that place where I understand, you know, this is a human being in pain and I am a human being with that same capacity. I can hear the music, sort of.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I'm a human being with that same capacity, and I want to meet you in that area.
Yeah. You know, I can hear this. Yes, that's a good image. I can hear the song you're singing. Yeah, I'm not the singer of the song, but I can hear it.
Mm-hmm.
The song that I'm hearing is actually an emotion, a feeling, and I really have no way without literally getting inside of your skin to know whether what I'm feeling is the same as what you're feeling. But it means that I'm open to being in this space with you.
Yeah, I like that. Another two more distinctions about sympathy versus empathy that I've also heard that I enjoy If I'm feeling pain, it's my pain. And I'm in, that's what we call sympathy, is when I'm feeling my pain in relation to your story. And empathy is when I'm really just putting my attention on your feelings and needs. And so I may not feel them. That's the experience you were just talking about. And the other part of sympathy versus empathy is in empathy, we're completely equals. And in sympathy, there's kind of a power overstructure going on. So, and that's the I feel sorry for you taken to a little bit more depth, is that somehow I can pity you that we're not equals anymore.
Yes, yes, that really. And I also love that description of empathy, that I'm giving you my attention, which means literally I'm not paying attention to my own feelings. So that's an interesting question. Those are two different things there.
And I don't know. I tend to think there's a space to see. Now we're getting into all the, it'd be great to have all people all over the world doing NVC, because you would never end this discussion. Is it possible, empathy, as far as I know, is really putting my full attention and focus on the other person's feelings and needs. What I most enjoy is when I'm really connected to my own at the same time. They're in the background, but I'm always got this subconscious connection, so that when one of my needs comes up that's not being met, that might prevent me from being more present to somebody else, I'm aware of it. I've got the radar going all the time, even though I'm choosing to really put my energy and focus on somebody else's needs. I don't have a sense that I ever give up my own. Does that make any sense?
Oh, yes. I would think that's crucial. Yes, because that's where the boundaries come in with this empathy thing. It's really easy to lose yourself in other people's feelings or needs. And that's a very critical thing, when you look at things like this, being with other people. And I think probably one of the most important things is just to be aware of my own self, my own physical reactions, my own emotional reactions. Mm-hmm. Clear boundaries.
Which brings us back to that whole thing on maybe choice and intention is, for me, a fundamental piece of communication. It's all the internal piece of communication that happens before the words. And it also brings us back to what Angana offered, was how to be really present in the moment and stay grounded and present in the moment. If I'm always got those roots going, I've got my radars out there for what's going on with me and the other person. And I'll fully acknowledge that this wouldn't go over with a lot of NVC trainers. I'm pretty sure... I'm curious how Marshall would, but I've often heard him say that when you're fully in empathy, you only have attention on the other person's feelings and needs. So it's an interesting discussion. I guess I like to play with it just to see where it fits with me and play with pushing it one way or the other, and just see where I'm comfortable.
Yeah, I think there's an interplay between presence. I really like the analogy of radar, because you can focus that radar or widen its scope so that something that's under the radar one moment can be within that beam. You can choose how you're focusing your beam and what your radar screen can cover. And so that, from moment to moment, you can make a choice. So you can be aware of the whole airspace, yours and theirs, and be aware of what's more significant within that at any moment. I don't think there's a dichotomy. What's occurring to me is that there doesn't have to be a difference between empathy and self-empathy. Within that presence, you can have both. And it's just a matter of if you're going to narrow that beam or not, and what you're going to narrow it on. Does that make sense?
Well, what comes up for me around that is a sense of I want to trust. I just want to trust that I am, and human beings are capable to be in that space where we can hold everyone's needs at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I have better luck than others at doing that. So I do like that. What comes up for me is trust. I want to trust that it's possible.
It's interesting when you were talking about Marshall's comment that your total attention is on the other person. I think I've had that experience. And what I've noticed about being in that experience is that, first of all, I'm really not trying to fix anything. I don't feel a need to protect myself. Usually pretty secure in my own body at these moments. And I've literally chosen to hear the other person's story. Mm. And usually what's probably active in me, I was just trying to remember, is a kind of curiosity. I'm trying to figure out what is being expressed to me. And it's as if I turn into a sort of big question mark. And it's like, what am I hearing? And I may literally be wondering what feelings, what needs are being presented to me.
Mm-hmm.
But in that moment, I'm probably not paying a lot of attention. I may not be having any reaction at all because I'm so, except to try and hear what is coming, what's being said
mm-hmm.
in terms of feelings and needs.
Yeah. And that reminded me of a couple experiences I've had when I've been in the empathy mode. Of literally, it's almost like I was observing it happening. I was watching myself doing empathy with somebody, and I didn't know what was going on for the other person. I was just watching it as an observer. And I remember a situation in a workshop where this person had brought up an issue that I'm sure he told very few people ever in his life, and he just simply got empathy for all the reasons he did what he did, for the needs that he was meeting then and the needs that weren't being met. He'd been so focused on all the needs that weren't being met. And I remember him saying, 20 years of healing just happened in this moment. I also remember going, yeah. I didn't have anything to do except to open the space. And that's very similar to Marshall sometimes talks about when he gets really stuck. He just says, what am I going to do here? And he just had this sense of, well, all you need to do is hold the space open, and you don't do the work. You know, life will do the work. You just hold it open. So I appreciate you bringing up what it's like to be in the midst of that. There's something about just jumping into the flow and realizing you're part of it.
It's like being an observer up on the little corner of the room.
Yeah.
As if you're not really even in that body. But you are. Yes, but it's very much an observer sort of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I think curiosity and wonder, you know, Marshall talks a lot about wonder and curiosity, and that might actually be another component, like presence. For there to be a connection, there's got to be some curiosity about that other being. There's a catalyst for that connection. You know, had this little tingly sensation when Mary Kay said she was curious. It's like, yeah, I think that's actually quite significant.
Mm-hmm. Really noticing that. You know, I really expected that we would start talking about tone of voice and nonverbal body language and all of those other things that we hear so much about, and there's been a lot of research done, that how, you know, emotions are planet-wide. There's all the muscles in the face twinge at exactly the same point for the same emotions planet-wide, and we haven't gone into that area at all. Or the research that the chemicals that exchange between people in the room, that how one person's emotions make chemical changes in other people, or how chemical changes happen simultaneously in the body. It's not, it happens at one place and then travels through the body with the speed of light. It just is simultaneous. So I really thought we'd be exploring some of that. And I'm curious if any of that holds interest to you in terms of this topic?
Oh, tremendously. Huge for me, actually. And the whole idea of the neurochemistry that goes on in relation to learning and to communication, everything, it's a tremendous interest. The other thing I was going to add to your list was this idea of mirror neurons, looking into a mirror. But a mirror neuron they've discovered in a lot of animals and people is you can see something. Say you can be watching somebody eat ice cream, and these neurons will send that message to the same neurons that are firing in that person who's eating the ice cream are firing in you.
Mm-hmm.
So, that, you know, it's a fascinating idea.
Wow. When I first heard that, I thought, oh, that explains it. Because if you ever walked into a room and just sort of gotten tense or,
yeah,
you know, picked up the feeling in the room, without a word being spoken or anyone moving from whatever they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I look at all that kind of research as some sort of, oh, good, you know, I'm not crazy.
And it's just that we're not, you know, science didn't have a way of showing any of that before. We keep discovering these new things.
So do you have some research? I know Daniel Goleman has done a lot of stuff in social intelligence, what happens in a group and how all of that has changed. But do you have any other resources that you would recommend?
I'll send you something. There's a book that I really like that kind of touches on a lot of this, and the book itself has lots of resources. And it's called Field Notes.
The Compassionate Life, by any chance?
Yes, Field Notes on the Compassionate Life.
It's sitting on my shelf right here, and I haven't read it yet.
This is it, A Search for the Soul of Human of Kindness. And it's, the author is Mark Ian Barash, B-R-A-S-C-H. He touches on a lot of this research and some experiences that he's had exploring this whole idea of empathy from a scientific
standpoint. Oh, that is so funny.
It's a great book.
That might be a great resource for this.
There's more specific resources in there.
So in some ways, part of the energy that we put into it is just suspending this disbelief that we have that we're separate.
Yeah.
Just the willingness to be open to the possibility of connection is a huge piece of successful communication.
Absolutely. You hear about, well, you get caught up in the stories, you get caught up in the assumptions that you have. All of those are really disconnecting.
Thank you. I appreciate this.
And what I'm thinking is, if the connection is unconscious or unacknowledged, you can actually get lost in the connection itself. Then in order to have good communication, you have to start with a good boundaries. You have to have the I and the thou. That's kind of an aspect that doesn't get discussed as much, but I think is also important to tuck in here. And that's where the attention thing comes in. I need to pay attention so that my I can speak with your thou, be present to your thou, and have an actual exchange between two whole, complete beings.
So I've got a little discomfort coming up around that, and I think it's so much about just the language, and how do I hold that paradox of that sense of oneness, and yet we have our own individual expression of that.
And that's the
key. I don't want to feed into the separateness, but I want to be, you know, clear that, hey, this is my energy to play with right now, and that's yours.
I think it is a paradox,
mm-hmm.
And I think you just described it perfectly.
What occurred to me is that, here we go with choice again, how that quality of attention and choice are intertwined, and sometimes we choose not to pay attention, or we're not paying attention. We are not in a position to make the choices that we'd like to. The choices to connect with ourselves or connect with the other, to weigh those needs.
And, you know, here's another thought I would like to interject. Oneness, this whole idea of oneness, is one of the things that, well, there's a pre-trans fallacy. An infant isn't separate from its mother. You know, it doesn't perceive separateness. Everything in the world is it. And then as a child develops, you know, they literally separate out and they discover that, you know, oh, you know, mom is a person over there and I'm a person over here. And then you re-enter into relationship. After you become separate, then you re-enter into relationship again. But you go through all these stages of development. And eventually there is another stage which the mystics talk about, mystical union, mm-hmm. oneness, which is in every religion that I've studied. And that's another thing, but that is not the same thing as the infant's experience of oneness, of union, which is in fact a non-different, you know, the infant has never differentiated a separate individual. So I think when you talk about oneness, you're speaking as a differentiated person who's quite aware of separateness and one's own being, going on to this other kind of union. And I think unless we're clear about these steps of development it's real easy to confuse pre-differentiated oneness and with this other kind of oneness, which is literally voluntarily surrendering into union. So that's just another thing to put in the hopper.
I really love these conversations, and they get, you know, so philosophical, and we use their language, and just because it's a fun playground for me, so I appreciate you going there for a while. And I'm also, I always find myself back at this point, at some point of breathing a little more quickly, and because there's a sense of it gets overwhelming, like, well, do I pay attention to this or this or this or this, and now there's suddenly so many choices. And it all comes back to that great mystery of knowing that I just have a sense that I can never know really what it looks like or put it into language. And so I come around to that place of really wanting a certain celebration in life and wanting to just celebrate the mystery and this journey that I'm on that I take so seriously sometimes and often need to take a big breath to come back to that place of just celebrating that we can connect. However that happens, it's a total mystery, no matter how hard we've tried to understand it in the last hour and a half.
Oh, it would take many more hours.
Oh, it's like, it just takes pause and celebrate. Even that we have that possibility, for whatever reason it is, to connect. I'm wondering if you had anything that you want to summarize or put together or something that is a burning statement to end it with.
This has been another great conversation, and I know you tried several times to get us onto the more specific aspects of nonverbal communication, and I would love to explore that more also. But I also really, really enjoyed where we did end up going. So I don't know if your original topic will have a chance for it at another time or not, but I would hope so. This was a delightful, delightful conversation and very thought-provoking, as always.
Thank you. And no, I had no agenda to go there. I just assumed it would, and I stuck with the places where I was much more familiar, that place of choice and intention, hoping that the two of you would bring up the areas where I wasn't as knowledgeable. So,
well, I just had fun. I don't really have any burning things to add. But I do think we've touched on a lot of important aspects of communication.
Yeah. I know that for me it's going to be very helpful. I was really hoping that we would just kind of brainstorm and follow where it would lead, because that will help me more centered. It's one of the most confusing ones for me, communication, but I'm not talking about language. I'm not talking about thought. Well, thank you. That puts us at the next week of looking at the strategies of influence. And that one's a huge one for me, and again, an area that I would love to explore. So maybe in light of homework, if you can, you know, anything that comes up around this topic, more communication, I'd love to hear next week. And also just trying to pay attention to strategies of influence that you might use in order to meet your needs, to inspire other people to join you in that process. If you want to create power with another person, what strategies are you choosing? Okay. Enjoy.